This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Thanks. Let's start having a look at Hilchos Tshuva. The enemy of change, what do you think the enemy of change is? Habit would be one. What else?
Fear
could paralyze one. Well, those are all the habit, fear are enemies of change. The biggest enemy of change is comfort. Which means, if we take that a little bit further, and we say, because if you're comfortable, there's no reason to change. If there's no reason to change, why change? Because change is hard. Any form of change is difficult. And people generally rate change as the most difficult of things. To change oneself, to significantly change, and even not such significant changes. If one's just talking about changing an environment, and emigration is very hard for a child to change from one school to another. Changing a job is very difficult. Sometimes even the simplest of little things. Do you know Spencer Johnson's book of Who Moved My Cheese? It's a bestseller about change. He simplifies and explains some of the difficulties in it. And when he was giving a lecture once that I attended, before he started, everybody was settled. It was a big auditorium, there were about 200 people in the auditorium. Before he started, he asked everybody to change their seats and sit somewhere else. And when everybody had done that, and it caused a big tumult, and everybody was running around, he asked people, what did that feel like? And some people said they were angry, and some people said they thought it was a chutzpah, they'd come early, and on this went. And then he said, and all I asked you to do was change your seat for 1 hour. Do you know what it's like when you change somebody's office around the place they work? You walk in one day and you tell them, you're not going to sit here, you're going to sit there. You're not going to report to this boss, you're going to report to that boss. It's traumatic. So change, even the little things are difficult and they're traumatic. To change ourselves significantly, to really change the way we operate, to change the way we think, to change the way we live our lives, that's incredibly difficult. And if we're comfortable where we are, there's no chance of succeeding. So comfort becomes the enemy of change. Which means, if we take that further, that discomfort must be the promoter of change. And what is it? What's another word for discomfort? Discomfort is when it's mild. What happens when the discomfort starts getting serious, starts getting heavy?
Pain.
It becomes painful. So that means then pain is a propeller of change. Would you agree with the logic? If comfort is the enemy of change, then pain must be the propeller of change. If pain is a propeller of change, what should we do when we experience pain?
Change.
The first thing, before we even change, the first thing we should say is Baruch Hashem. Thank God for pain. Because if I didn't suffer the pain, I would be in the same old place. That's why the Gemara says, K'shem shemavarachim ala tova, kach mavarachim ala ro. That's why you've got to make a bracha for pain. You've got to make a bracha for the things. You've got to make a bracha for the uncomfortable things as well. It's not only the good things. It's true, the good things we make a bracha for because we feel the chesed of Hashem. But the chesed of Hashem is just as great when we feel pain. Because every pain is an opportunity for change. Every pain is a message. Every ein yisurin below chet. The Gemara says, there's no pain without you having done something wrong. Doesn't mean that there's some serious avera that you... It just means your attitude is wrong. Your approach is wrong. Your mindfulness is wrong. Your attention to detail is wrong. Your sincerity is wrong. The way you're coming across to other people is wrong. Something you're doing is wrong. Because ein yisurin below chet. There's no form of suffering and pain without some form of sin. And yisurin itself is an interesting word. Yisurin is the same word as musar. So musar is also about pain. And both words come from the word sar, which is to move. That's how you create movement. You create through movement, through the pain of musar. Because musa, which isn't painful, isn't musa. So to sit and learn, let's say that's a short, or Shari Tshuva as an intellectual exercise and get all wrapped up in the lomdas of the philosophy of what does this word mean and what does that word mean and where is the makor for it and where does he get it from. That's great, that's learning Torah, but that's not Musar. Musar is you've got to feel pain. If you don't feel deep discomfort while you're learning Musar, emotional discomfort, if your chest doesn't tighten up and your stomach doesn't get all sore and you don't go away with a headache and you feel mildly depressed, then you haven't learned Musar. You've had a good discussion on some philosophic concept, but that's not Musa. Musa comes from Yisurin. In Musa, there's pain. What is the nature of that pain? The most painful thing for a Baal Nefesh is vidui, to acknowledge that we're off track. That's the hardest thing for a Baal Nefesh. Because just think for a moment. For a Baal Nefesh, what is the most valuable thing is his Ruchnius. For a Baal Nefesh, the most valuable thing is where he's holding spiritually, and he realizes that he's got a limited amount of time to invest entirely in his spirituality. But after the end of his life, there's no more investment. That's the time to benefit from investment. So Olam Habo is retirement time. What's retirement time? If you've invested all your life, you know, sometimes I feel a bit sorry for people who've invested all their lives. They've gone without all their lives because they're busy investing, so that the last couple of years they can retire. But with Olam Haba, it does work like that. There is a concept. You spend all your life investing in yourself so that after 120 years you can relax and enjoy the fruits of your investment for the rest of eternity, because there's no more investment after that. You can't invest after that. That's it. The investment opportunities are over. So if somebody is a person who's very involved in money, and that's the most important value to him, then he understands the value of time. Time is money. Every bit of every opportunity he's got is an opportunity to build his wealth. And if he wastes that opportunity, he's concerned about that. If he loses money, he's concerned about that. If he puts a lot of money into an investment that goes bad, he suffers terrible pain. He suffers terrible anguish. As a result of that, it's not just the loss of the money, it's the loss of the opportunity. Because he thinks to himself, I had R1 million or dollars, and I put $1 million into an investment. That investment went bad, so I've now only got $100,000. I've lost $900,000. It's not just the loss of the $900,000 which causes him pain. He does the calculation. If the investment had gone well, my $1 million would have become $2 million. I would have kept the $1 million invested and pulled out the other $1 million. I would have invested that in something else. Now I've got 2 investments of $1 million. And in 2 or 3 years' time, I would have $5 million. And in 10 years' time, I would have $20 million. And that $20 million is what's gone. It's not the $900,000. He sees the whole future. And he realizes that the whole projected future of his investment is gone. That's the Agnus Nefesh. That's the suffering that a Baal Esek, a businessman, goes through when an investment goes wrong. So we who deal in matters of the spirit, we who deal in matters of the soul, think about it in exactly the same way. So if there was an opportunity to invest in my neshama and I didn't invest, it's not just that day that's gone. It's all the benefit that could have been generated. Had that day been a good day, then it would have taken me in all sorts of directions. So there's terrible pain in looking back on a day and saying, wow, this day was a waste. Or even worse than a waste, this day was actually negative. I did things that I didn't want to do that I shouldn't really have done. So when we have a genuine vidui is not just going through a number of words. Vidui is looking at what ought to have been and what was and filling the gap. And filling the gap is a very, very difficult place to be. Very, very painful. And one of the weaknesses of our society is that we value comfort. And in a sense, that's okay. It's interesting, possibly if you were to ask me what was unique about Lithuania, about Torah society in Lithuania, it was probably that they didn't value comfort. That was probably one of the most important elements of Lithuania. So it wasn't important to be comfortable. Probably at the core, that was what it was. It wasn't that they were poor. It wasn't because that they were uncomfortable because they were poor. They were poor because comfort wasn't important. What do you think? Those Lithuanian mines, those Geonim and Iluim, couldn't have gone into business and made a lot of money? Of course they could have. But what, they weren't poor because they weren't uncomfortable because they were poor. They were poor because comfort wasn't important. So that they just didn't rate comfort. In the United States today, comfort is, I believe, the most important value. You know, if an American goes to a supermarket and buys margarine that you have to struggle to spread, doesn't just spread easily, he takes it back to the store. That's not okay. I don't want to struggle to spread my margarine. I don't want to struggle for anything. So we live in a society, and it's not just in the United States today, so that's become a culture all over the world, where we expect, we feel entitled to comfort. And anything that's not entirely comfortable, we don't pursue. That's why gyms make a lot of money. What do gyms make money out of? About the people who don't get, but it's the only business that makes money from the people who don't come. Every other business makes money when you come. A gym makes money from people when they don't come. That enables them to sell many more memberships than they can possibly accommodate. If everybody came, they would have to sell fewer memberships, and the memberships would be very expensive. So really, the people who don't come subsidize the people who do go. People who do go to gym get it cheaply because lots of people buy memberships and don't go. Why do they buy memberships and why don't they go? Well, they don't go because it's uncomfortable to go. People don't like discomfort. Why do they buy the membership? Because they would like to go. That's the gap between what you would like to be and what you are. And if a person, let's say a person stands on the scale and sees that they're overweight and their clothes aren't fitting them, and the doctor does a few tests and says, this is not looking good, you've got to take care of yourself, you've got to lose some weight, you've got to get fit, this is not okay. So they get into a mode, they're going to do something about it. So they sign up to a gym. They pay a year's membership or they pay 2 years membership because this is now really important. And then it's uncomfortable to go. There's no time, it's difficult, it's a hassle, so they don't go after a while. Comes around, they've got to confront the fact that they know better than they were. In fact, maybe they're weighing a little bit more than they were, and their blood tests are a little bit worse than they were. Things aren't good. In our pursuit of comfort, we tend to move off that moment and run away from it as quickly as possible. So yeah, the doctor says, and before very long, we distract ourselves. We go to the movies, we'll do anything just to distract ourselves from that. But what would happen if that person just sat down for a moment and really thought and really felt the disappointment? I undertook to do it. I promised myself I would do it. I promised myself I would do it because it's important to me. Nobody said I had to. The doctor advised me. I took the advice. I went and invested money. It was so important to me that I went and invested money. My own health. And I haven't been able to take care of myself? What chance have I got of taking care of anybody else? I can't even take care of my body. What chance is there of taking care of my soul? I can't take care of my body. What chance is there of doing chesed for other people? What kind of a human being am I that I can't do the things I want to do? So what can I do? Only the things I'm forced to do? Is that where I am? That I can only do the things that I'm forced to do? I can't do anything that I want to do? Imagine the person sat in that space for a while. Now they would get a little depressed, wouldn't they?
A lot depressed.
And what would the outcome of that depression be? There's only one way they're going to get out of that depression. You either have a drink or you go to gym. And you say things are changing now. Have you noticed how many times we say we're going to change from tomorrow? Ever heard that? Have you ever said that to yourself? From tomorrow, that's it. Why do we say from tomorrow? Why don't we say today? Because we know tomorrow never comes. Because tomorrow is tomorrow. And then tomorrow means never. When a person says from tomorrow, read never. That's what you must understand. Because if they mean it for real, they wouldn't say from tomorrow, they would say from now. Right now. If somebody's about to stretch their hand out for a delicious marshmallow, and they say, you know what, my last one. After this, I'm going on diet. You know they're not going on diet. It's not serious. Because it'll always be the last one. The person's putting out their hand and says, not going to have it. That's serious. That's change. So we constantly confront ourselves. And if one would say, if we felt the pain, it wouldn't be from tomorrow. You know what, Chas v'Shalom, if somebody's got severe chest pains, and they're having a heart attack, while that's happening, they don't exactly have a stake. And even if they felt like it, they wouldn't. And they don't smoke a cigarette, even if they're dying for one. They, at that moment, they stop. You know, when the chest pains go, then things are different again. But at that moment, they don't stay when they've got their chest pains. They don't say, last one. This is my last cigarette. From tomorrow, I'm stopping. From today. That's the power of pain. Pain makes you change now. Intellect makes you change tomorrow. And that never happens. That's the beauty of pain. That's why Kashem Shemavorchim Ala Tovo, Kach Mavorchim Ala Ro. We've got to thank the Ribbono Shel Olam for the pain too. Because the pain enables us, if we'll sit with the pain a little bit, if that person who hadn't been going to gym would sit with it and feel that depression and give themselves musr and break down in tears and then say to themselves, so what do I do? They wouldn't say, well, from tomorrow I'll start. They would, right away, they would go and do something about it immediately. That's the power of pain. And vidui is a painful process. Vidui is word, is mouthing it, actually saying, I've let myself down, I've let my neshama down, I've let the Ribbono Shel Olam down. Because I know what I ought to have done, and I haven't done it. Now here comes the dangerous place, and that is one can wallow in vidui forever, and then pain, one becomes addicted to the pain. That's also a problem. You can get to a point where it feels quite good to be in pain, because it makes you feel alive, it makes you feel, at least I feel the pain, I feel regret, I feel remorse. People are always saying they're sorry, but they never change. They kind of enjoy being sorry. Shouldn't have to say sorry for the same thing twice. If you're sorry, you're sorry once and it never happens again. If it happens again, you're not really sorry. And then the sorry becomes just a self-fulfilling thing. So one has to be careful that vidui isn't a process. That vidui leads in itself to what? What does vidui then lead to? If you feel the pain of vidui, and you look and you really feel pain, and I mean physical pain. If the pain is only emotional, if you can't feel it somewhere in your body, it's not yet a good vidui. Any emotion that is meaningful and deep, you will feel in your body. And anything you feel in your body, you'll feel as an emotion as well. There is a very close link between what you feel in your body, physical feeling, and emotional feeling. They all affect one another. That's what the Sefer HaChinuch says. But achar alev nimshachim ha'maisim, isn't that the Loshon? That one's deeds follow one's heart. Action follows feeling follows action. That's how we can control emotions, by action. And that's how we can control actions, by emotions. There's a link between the two. There's a causality. So if one's feeling, if you're going through the vidui and you're not feeling anything physical discomfort, then you're not there yet. When you sit with the vidui properly and you go deeply into enough and you really confront it and you see where you ought to, just like that businessman who has a look and sees what that $1 million could become or would have become had the investment been successful, and he sees what that loss is and he feels the pain of it, and he makes changes. So it is with the vidui. If one actually feels the change, then what results in that? What do? You make a change. And what do we call the change? That we call teshuvah. That's what teshuvah is. And that explains the Rambam's dealing with vidui and teshuvah in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, in Mitzvahs Asei Ayin Gimel, where the Rambam says, He shetivonu lihisvados al ha'avonos v'chatoim shechatonu lifnei ha'kel. The mitzvah 73 is to be misvade, to admit, to confess on the various types of averes, avonos, chatoim, that we've sinned before Hashem. V'loimar oisom im ha'tshuva, and to say that, to actually articulate that with teshuva. But I looked right through the Sefer HaMitzvahs to try and find where is the mitzvah of tshuva. Doesn't count. Isn't one. Doesn't say anywhere you're mechuyev to do tshuva. And what about the Rambam in Yad HaChazaka? What does he say at the beginning of Hilchos Tshuva? What would you expect him to say? That Adam b'Yisrael, kasher chota, when he sins, Yoshuv, v'yisvade, I would have thought he would have said something like that. He must do tshuva and say vidu. Kol mitzvah sheba teiro bein also bein lo tase, says the Rambam. Every mitzvah in the Torah, whether an asay or a lo tase, Im ovar odom al achas mehen, if a person is over on one of them, bein bezodo in bein bishagogo, whether deliberately or by mistake, keshi yase teshuva v'yoshuv mechetoi, when he does tshuva and he comes back from the avero, chayiv liisvados lifnei Hashem, hakel baruch hu, he must say vidui. And there's some interesting things here first. He says when he will do tshuva. He doesn't say if he'll do tshuva. He says if he does an avero, one would think that averos are inevitable. When you do an avero, this is what you do. Rambam doesn't say when you do an avero. The Rambam says if you do an avero. That's not inevitable. But bechira, you don't have to be doing averos. Tshuva, when you do tshuva. It's a chiddush in the Rambam. Tshuva is inevitable. If you've done an avero, you will regret it. The only question is when. You know you've done wrong, that's the human condition. You know you've done something, you know you've missed an opportunity, you will regret it. When that day happens, say vidui. In other words, there's a condition for vidui. You say vidui when you're doing tshuva. In the Sefer HaMitzvahs, how does he word it? You've got to say vidui with tshuva. But as I said, tshuva is not, it doesn't say that you must do tshuva. Tshuva then is a natural state. You've got to feel. Tshuva is an emotion. And there are no mitzvahs in the Torah that obligate, that legislate emotions. Other than Yirah Shamayim maybe is an emotion that the Torah legislates. V'ahavta, the Ramban says, can't mean you must love people because you can't legislate love. The Ramban says, v'ahavta means you must act as if you love them. You must do things. V'ahavta Hashem Elokecha, you've got to love the Ribono Shelayim. So that's the only area where there seems to be legislated emotion is in our relationship with the Ribono Shelayim. Yirah Shamayim and Avas Hashem. Where there seems to be, and even Avas Hashem, how does the Rambam define Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem? What does the Rambam call it at the beginning of Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah? Akel HaNichbad, in Perek Beis, Akel HaNichbad V'Anoira HaZeh, this great Hashem, Mitzvah L'Avo L'Yiro Yisro. V'Hechi HaDerech L'Avo S'Yiro Yisro. How do you do it? B'shoshi is b'inin ha'odom b'masa v'vura v'nifloim ha'gdoidim v'yira mehim chokhmasa and so on. He gives you a process of how to get there. How you get to an ava. You've got to study Hashem and you kind of get to an ava. So even there that there's process for, but there we have some kind of legislated emotion, but it's difficult to legislate an emotion. The Torah hardly ever does it. And tshuva seems to be a state, it's got to be so authentic. You can legislate vidui because vidui doesn't have to be authentic. Vidui is a formula. The more authentic it is, the more effective it is. But the fact is, you've got to say certain things. So you can say them. You can legislate a formula. And most of the mitzvahs are formulas. Then comes questions. Mitzvahs triches kavona or not triches kavona. Whole questions. But the things that are legislated are formulas. Actions. Tshuva, you can't legislate. Tshuva, you've got to feel. And all the Ramban says is, when you have that feeling of tshuva, then you can do vidui. There's no point in doing vidui before you're doing tshuva. So let's read the words again and understand them. Kol mitzvah shabbat Torah ben ase ben lo itase. Any mitzvah in the Torah, whether a positive or a negative commandment. Im ovar odom al achas mehem. If a person, just look at that beautiful language. Should a person be over on one of them? Just look at the way the Rambam's assumptions start. And it's not that we're just engrossed in averus. Just should a person cross that line once and do one avera, whether bezodo or bishgoga, whether deliberately or by mistake, kashiyase teshuva, when you come back from that state, when you say to yourself, I don't want to be doing that again, I want to change, v'yoshuv mecheto, you want to return from that, from the chet, chayev lihisvados lifnei hakel baruch hu, you've got to do a vidui before the Ribbono Shel Olam. So vidui is not something we do privately with ourselves, nor is vidui something that we do with a priest in confession. Vidui is something we do before the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. Shenema isho isho ki yasu v'isvadu es chatosom asher oso. Also they must do vidui for the avera which they did. Ze vidui dvorim. This is called verbal vidui. Doing vidui verbally, which is the first step in personal accountability. The very first step in personal accountability is acknowledging the wrong. And that's one of the hardest things. when you look at the difference between when Shaul HaMelech did something he shouldn't have done and when David HaMelech did something he shouldn't have done. And many ask the question, whose was worse? Shaul HaMelech, who gave in to the pressure of the nation and didn't wait for Shmuel and didn't wipe out every bit of the Amalekim because the people were pressured. But apart from that, it was a tzaddik gamur. Everybody says Shaul HaMelech, we're told, was ahead above everybody else. He never did a chet like the Rambam. One chet. He never did an avera. Shaul HaMelech was a tzaddik olam. And David HaMelech gets up to stuff. And although we can't understand it, and we on our level, we don't. It's impossible to understand. But the fact is, the Tanakh reports averas that David HaMelech did. Not one, several times, many times. Shaul was the one avera. The whole of Shaul, one avera. And then he gets a bit irritated with David. And he loses it a little bit. But in terms of avera, David HaMelech, what is David HaMelech's avera? An abuse of his power? For personal gain? He wants a relationship with Bathsheba, sends her husband off to the front, has him killed. What would happen to somebody if this was discovered today about an army general? Can you imagine what would happen that an army general did such a thing? Can you imagine what would happen to him? Would he ever recover again? Would he ever become a hero again? Can't be. David HaMelech's fine. He's a recovered hero. How did he do it? How does David HaMelech recover from something so awful? And Shaul HaMelech never recovers, loses his kingdom, never recovers. Because when Shmuel confronts Shaul, what does he say? It wasn't me, it was the people, and they were pressuring, and it was this, and it was that. And what does David say when he's chatas? Immediately, I've sinned. That's the difference. We can't avoid sinning. That's Chazal said tshuva was created before the world. If tshuva was created before the world, then chet was created before the world. That means the Ribbono Shel Olam designed the world with chet and tshuva into it. He almost wants chet, because he could have designed the world in such a way that we can't sin. Imagine if every time somebody did an avera, they were struck down by a bolt of lightning. How many times would we do averas? We would notice it happening once, we would notice it two, three, four times. The scientists would get together to figure out what's the connection. They would figure the only connection they can find is these are people who do averas. Whenever you do an avera, boom, there you're gone, you're finished. That would be the end of averas. The Ribbono Shel Olam could have dealt with it that way. He doesn't. He builds into the world this gap between where we want to be and where we are and gives us the mitzvah of tshuva in order to be able to do that. Because we can't be mekayim the mitzvah of tshuva if we haven't done an avera first. And tshuva is a big thing. Vidu is a big mitzvah. Tshuva is a big mitzvah, even though it doesn't count as one of the tariag mitzvahs, but it's part of the mitzvah of vidu, it's part of the korbonos, it's part of tefillah, it's part of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We see tshuva as a theme that comes over and over again. Tshuva is a huge mitzvah that you can't do without an avera. Now, I'm not suggesting that we go out and do averas in order to have the opportunity to do tshuva. We don't have to go out and make a special effort. It's unfortunately it's something which we have plenty of it. There's probably no mitzvah that we have so much opportunity to do than tshuva, and yet it's probably the mitzvah we do least. We have wonderful opportunities all the time. The Ribbono Shel Olam almost built the world with tshuva in it. He doesn't. Kibyochel, it's as if the Ribbono Shel Olam says to us, "I don't mind that much if you sin. I understand it. It's going to happen. I gave you a good, strong, powerful yetzer hara. I put lots of temptations in the world. You don't have much of a chance. The truth is, you don't have much of a chance. You're going to be doing averas. I've designed the world that way. I've built the world that way. I can take it that you're going to do averas. I just want to see how you react when you've done an avera. That's what's important. Do you do tshuva or do you rationalize? That's what's important. Do you find all sorts of reasons of why you didn't take care of your health, and why you couldn't go to the gym, and why you couldn't cut your diet, and why you couldn't be careful? A million reasons. Or do you say chatasi, and feel the pain, and fix it from now? Not from tomorrow, but from now. So that's what I want to see. David HaMelech did a terrible thing. Whether we can understand it or we not, Tanakh says it was a terrible thing. The Novi says it was a terrible thing. Clearly it was a terrible thing. That's not the issue. He recovers. He recovers because of chatos, he recovers because of teshuvah.